welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, June 8th, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the story today, summer fun rolls in. And this is accompanied by a photo of children playing outside in several relay events. Monday was the first day of the summer rec-mobile program. The city launched the program in 2020 as a way to bring recreational programming close to neighborhoods to reduce transportation barriers. The Rec-Mobile will visit parks citywide on a weekly rotation, Monday through Saturday, with games, activities, and recreational equipment. Youth can participate at no cost at any park as many times per week as they like. Also on the front page, this story by Vanessa Miller, Iowa OKs millions in Regent-related settlements. The state agreed Monday to pay $5.7 million to offer compensation for or settle eight separate accusations of discrimination and negligence at its public universities, including payments to former University of Iowa police officers who sued for age discrimination, a sound tech hurt at a University of Northern Iowa concert, and a UI student who crashed her moped after slipping on CAM bus fuel. As the settlements include several allegations of medical negligence at the UI hospitals and clinics, the UI Physicians Group is paying $2.7 million of the total, with the state general fund covering the remaining $3 million. So far this budget year, which ends June 30, the state has paid from its general fund $4.67 million to settle lawsuits or comply with judgments against state entities. Of that, $4.1 million, or 88%, is related to Board of Regents institutions. Among the biggest checks approved Monday for $1.8 million went to a Massachusetts man who on February 21, 2016, was working as a sound technician for a Luke Bryan concert at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. The person in a lawsuit filed September 18, 2018, accused University of Northern Iowa Assistant Director of Facilities and Operations, Trenton Ames, of hitting him with a forklift he was operating in reverse while tearing down after the concert, striking his leg and ankle. The person was loading sound and staging equipment into a truck at the time he was hit by the forklift that was owned by the state, according to his lawsuit. He accused Ames of failing to maintain a proper lookout, maintain control of the forklift, and act as a reasonable driver. He accused the state of failing to properly train and supervise Ames and for trusting the equipment to him in the first place. A jury in April ruled in his favor, awarding him $302,791 for past damages, $1.5 million for future damages, and $2,468 for recoverable costs. The state settled for a total $150,000 with three former UI police officers who in December 2018 sued the institution and its administrators for creating and enabling a, quote, culture of discrimination, end quote, including age and disability discrimination. Former UI Associate Director of Public Safety William Searles, who was 57 at the time, former Captain Ian Scott, 54 at the time, and former Captain Lauren Noska, 51 at the time, accused then Public Safety Director Scott Beckner, Associate Director David Visson, and Senior Vice President of Finance and Operations Rod Lennertz of the discrimination. In their lawsuits, the former employees reported Beckner in April 2017, told them their positions were being eliminated as part of a reorganization amid budget concerns, even as younger employees saw their pay increased. All three in their lawsuits accused Beckner of treating younger white male employees more favorably than employees protected by the Iowa Civil Rights Act, including special treatment in assignments, duties, promotions, and disciplinary action, such as refusing to order internal affairs investigations on younger male employees who were reported to have violated department or university policies, as well as state law. In a statement to the Gazette in 2018, UI spokeswoman Janine Beck said Beckner reorganized the department after careful review of the department's governance, structure, budget, and priorities moving forward. Beckner, after 4 years on the job, retired at the end of 2020. He had intended to leave in June but extended his stay through the end of the fall 2020 semester due to COVID-19. As part of the state's new settlements with Searles, Scott, and Noska, they've agreed to drop from their claims defendants Vissen and Lennertz, maintaining the allegations against the UI and Beckner. The state, on May 24, had agreed to settle with each of the former officers for different amounts. Noska and his attorneys will receive $75,000, Searles and his lawyers will get $50,000, and Scott and his counsel will receive $25,000. Another UI-related settlement pays UI student Hannah Moore $25,000 after she lost control and crashed her moped in May 2018 by slipping on diesel fuel that had spilled out of a UI Bionic CAM bus. According to Moore's April 2020 lawsuit, the fuel cap was left off the CAM bus when it finished fueling the evening of May 5, 2018, spilling diesel along the roadway. When Moore drove over the spilled fuel, she lost traction. She suffered injuries to her neck, shoulder, and hand, along with road rash and $900 in damage to her moped. Among the recent UIHC settlements, one totaling $3.5 million went to an Iowa City mother and father who accused physicians of negligence during the birth of their daughter. The state has agreed to pay $875,000 of the total, with the UI Physicians Group covering $2.63 million. Chanta Burr and Ebony Burton Payne sued the state and UIHC in March 2019. After their baby suffered seizure activity shortly after birth and was diagnosed with a lack of oxygen. In their lawsuit, the couple reports that after being admitted for labor induction at 38 weeks pregnant, a doctor educated them on the risks of induction and asked the mother to sign a consent of possible cesarean section. Ebony was not offered the option of a non-labor primary cesarean delivery, according to the lawsuit. After days of labor and numerous complexities and challenges, the baby was born just before 7:30 p.m. September 2, according to the lawsuit. With the baby suffering fetal distress and low oxygen, a neonatal resuscitation team was called to the delivery room. In the days that followed, the baby suffered increased seizure activity, and she was discharged from the neonatal intensive care unit October 5 with permanent brain damage. According to the state settlement, the $3.5 million deal is reasonable under the circumstances as the baby continues to have seizures. She is unable to speak, sit, feed herself, or walk. She will require lifelong care, the settlement said. And in another Iowa front page story from the Gazette, Iowa prison visits to restart in early July. The story by Aaron Jordan. The Iowa Department of Corrections will resume in-person visits for inmates in early July, provided the offender is vaccinated against COVID-19. Department spokesman Cord Overton said officials have been looking at other states and talking with public health officials about how to allow visitors again for the first time since March 2020. "We do believe early July will be the right time for us to start in-person visitation," Overton told the Board of Corrections last Friday. "All inmates that receive visitors will be required to be vaccinated. Otherwise, they will have to receive their visits via the video visitation system we have in place." More than 85% of people incarcerated in Iowa's prisons are fully vaccinated, while 62% have had one shot. The full vaccination rate among prison staff is 56%. "Once the word is spread around about the visitation restriction, I would expect to see more inmates get vaccinated," Overton said. Visitors would not have to be vaccinated. Overton said the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention's guidance for visitation at long-term care facilities specifically mentions the patient should be fully vaccinated, but does not say the same for visitors. "We are trying to balance our policy between risk, feasibility, and reasonable prudence," he said. Iowa's prisons and jails banned visitors in early March 2020 as cases of COVID-19 started mounting in Iowa. Since the pandemic began, more than 4,800 people incarcerated in Iowa's prisons have gotten the disease, and 19 have died from it. There were 6 positive tests Monday among Iowa's more than 7,500 prisoners. More than 700 prison staff have contracted the virus, and 2 staff have died from COVID-19. While halting visits was viewed as necessary to protect offenders from the highly contagious disease, the move can increase offenders' risks of reoffending once they are released, studies show. A study of 16,420 people released from Minnesota's prisons between 2003 and 2007 showed any visit cut the chance of the released person committing a felony by 13% and reduced the likelihood of the person committing a technical violation, such as parole violation, by 25%, according to a 2016 paper by In the Public Interest, a national nonprofit that studies public goods and services. During the pandemic, Iowa prison offenders have been allowed free video visits, which will continue even after the visitor ban is lifted. The Corrections Department is developing a new scheduling system so visitors will know when they will be able to see their loved ones instead of coming during general visitor hours. The agency also is developing rules that could include masking and social distancing in the visiting spaces. The department will be communicating these changes to incarcerated people and their families in coming weeks, Overton said. Since a March 23 attack at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, where 2 inmates are accused of the bludgeoning deaths of 2 employees, Iowa's prisons have suspended all work and apprenticeship programs. Anamosa still is on restricted movement, meaning offenders get only a couple hours a day outside their cells. Overton said it's possible Anamosa visits will be delayed somewhat after the other prisons because of multiple security reviews there. The board Friday named Chris Carberg as the new warden at Anamosa. Moving to the Iowa Today page, this story by Lee Hermiston, Johnson County holds special election today. Voters will go to the polls today in a special election to fill an open seat on the Johnson County Board of Supervisors. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. Voting takes place at regular voting locations. The 3 men vying for the open seat on the board are Brian Campbell, an independent, John Green, a Democrat, and Phil Hemingway, a Republican. Whoever is elected will serve the remainder of Janelle Redding's term, which expires December 31st, 2022. Redding announced her resignation in April, and county officials voted to hold a special election rather than appoint someone to fill the rest of the term. The county's 5 supervisors are paid $84,836 a year. Also on the Iowa Today page, Linn County taking applications for grants. This story by Gage Miskeman. Linn County is accepting Economic and Community Development Fund grant applications. The fund was established to foster and support economic growth and enhance quality of life in Linn County, according to a Monday news release. The competitive grant process is open to eligible organizations in Linn County or that have a branch in Linn County and whose work benefits county residents, the release said. This year, $200,000 is available to give out. Grant funds must be used for projects or programs that benefit county residents. Priority is given to projects that promote economic growth or community development in the county, demonstrate return on investment dollars, do not duplicate current initiatives, and demonstrate a sustainability plan for project continuation beyond county funding. The application deadline is 5 p.m. July 1, and applicants can find further information on the county's website, linncounty.org. Also on today's Iowa Today page, Cedar Rapids man found with stolen gun in Iowa City. This story by Lee Hermiston. A Cedar Rapids man was found with a stolen gun Saturday in downtown Iowa City. An officer witnessed a fight involving Brandon M. Kiefer on the Ped Mall around 1:52 a.m., according to Iowa City Police criminal complaints. Kiefer turns 20 today. Police said when officers approached Kiefer, he fled while clearly holding something in his front waist. Kiefer approached a vehicle, leaned toward it, and then ran, police said. Police said they recovered a gun underneath the vehicle. The gun had been reported stolen in Cedar Rapids. Kiefer was captured and faces charges of trafficking in stolen weapons, control of a firearm by a felon, and interference with official acts with a dangerous weapon, all Class D felonies. He also faces one count of carrying weapons, an aggravated misdemeanor. He remains in custody on a $20,000 cash or surety bond. And also on today's Iowa Today page, this story by Trish Mahaffey. Man charged with killing Meeks is deemed competent for trial. The man charged with fatally shooting Dexter Meeks and attempting to kill his brother in 2011 has been found competent for trial, and a judge reset the trial date for July 13 in Linn County District Court. The criminal proceedings for Michael A. Roberts, age 29, charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and going armed with intent, have been on hold since April when his lawyers asked the court for Roberts to undergo a competency evaluation at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville. No details of the competency evaluation are available in court records. But 6th Judicial District Judge Chad Kepros, in his order, said the evaluation concluded Roberts is competent, meaning he understands the charges against him and is able to assist his lawyers in his defense. The proceedings had been suspended pending the outcome. The case went cold for nearly 10 years until Roberts ended up serving time in Wasco State Prison in California. He was charged in this case in February. Roberts was serving a sentence for a series of armed robberies in Turlock and Modesto, California, according to the Turlock Journal. Roberts confessed to the June 26, 2011 fatal shooting of Meeks, age 22, and the attempt to kill his brother Andrew, age 20, who was sitting next to him on the porch outside Dexter's apartment, 211 15th Street Southeast, the complaint stated. Roberts told authorities he intended to kill Andrew Meeks that early morning instead of his brother. At the time of the shooting, Andrew Meeks was unable to identify his brother's shooter. He told police his brother had pushed him out of the line of fire that day. Though police pursued tips and lines of inquiry, investigators ran out of leads and the case went cold by 2012. Andrew Meeks was killed July 2, 2017, when he and another man were shot inside a car at the Westside Walmart. Corzone Martin, age 29, of Cedar Rapids, was convicted in that slaying, though the conviction was overturned last summer by the Iowa Court of Appeals. Martin will be retried June 21st. Last year, the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department in Modesto, California, called Cedar Rapids Police cold case investigator Matt Denlinger, saying an inmate, Roberts, had information about a 2011 murder in Cedar Rapids, but was uncertain of the victim's name. In April of last year, Roberts provided investigators with a complete, detailed confession that supported and corroborated many details of the shooting, according to court documents. And gunfire hits a man in Iowa City, and the shooter is sought. This story by Lee Hermiston. A man was hit by gunfire in Iowa City early Sunday. According to police, an officer driving in the 1900 block of Broadway Street at 1:36 a.m., heard multiple gunshots. One round ricocheted in front of the police officer's patrol vehicle, police said. The officer could not determine where the shots were coming from, but saw a man running south away from Highway 6. The officer located the man in Pepperwood Plaza. He was suffering from 3 gunshot wounds, police said. The officer pulled the man to cover and provided first aid until other officers arrived and the man could be safely turned over to medical personnel. The man told police he did not know who shot him or why. He was treated for non-life-threatening injuries at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. The shooter has not been located, and police are asking the public to provide any information they know about the incident. Anyone with information, including potential security camera footage, is asked to contact the police department at 319-356-5275. Iowa City Area Crime Stoppers is offering a reward of up to $1,000 for any tips leading to an arrest. And turning now to the Insight page, The guest editorial today is a reprint from the Washington Post. It titled, Help Our Afghan Allies. President Joe Biden's decision to pull out of Afghanistan brings with it a task just as complex as withdrawing the troops. Thousands of Afghans served shoulder to shoulder with the United States and other NATO forces as interpreters and in other essential functions. They are at risk of retribution from the Taliban. The United States must prepare an orderly exit for them and avoid a Saigon-like final hour. Biden's deadline of September 11 means time is short. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Mark Milley, told reporters, there are plans being developed very, very rapidly here, not just interpreters, but a lot of other people that have worked with the United States. He also said their safety could be at risk. All the debate about the costs and consequences of a forever war must not obscure the profound obligation of the United States to protect Afghan interpreters and their families from being slaughtered by the Taliban once the troops are gone. Many of them risked their lives to serve the United States. Congress over the years has approved special immigrant visas for these Afghans to come to the United States, but the program was plagued by delays and strict requirements that left applicants waiting years for approval. According to the International Refugee Assistance Project, about 18,000 Afghan interpreters and others are in the pipeline. The total special immigrant visa program cap is 26,500, of which, as of December, 15,507 had been issued and 10,993 remained. If families are included at an estimated rate of 4 per visa, the total number of people needing processing would be closer to 70,000. With so little time remaining, the refugee agency has properly suggested surging resources to the visa program to reach as many eligible people as possible before the deadline and keeping it open after the troop departure. However, the visa program is not sufficient by itself to provide a path to safety for all those in need. As the IRAP has proposed, the Pentagon should be planning for a mass evacuation if necessary, perhaps to relocation sites. Another possibility is to consider widespread use of parole processing into the United States. This does not confer immigration status, but could be used to admit large numbers of people who would then apply for various pathways, such as visas or asylum. The U.S. refugee program could also be expanded to cover Afghans not covered by the visa program, such as at-risk humanitarian aid workers, activists, and journalists. And again, that's a reprint from the Washington Post. At Liberty by Adam Sullivan today is titled, Big Gov is Back, Iowa Wants a Cut. A decade ago, Congress put an end to earmarks, a controversial budgeting tactic that allowed members to secure federal funding for specific projects in their district, also known as pork barrel spending. The earmark ban was a product of the first Tea Party Congress, elected during the 2010 midterms. Then-President Barack Obama joined Republicans in opposing the practice, calling it bad Washington habit that wastes millions, billions of taxpayer dollars. Obama at the time sounded a little bit like fellow former Democratic President Bill Clinton did in 1996, when he declared at the State of the Union address that the era of big government is over. The bipartisan consensus for fiscal restraint, albeit rhetorical more than genuine, is now over. Joe Biden is president, and the era of big government is back. Biden in March signed a nearly $2 trillion pandemic relief package, dubbed the American Rescue Plan. He is also proposing trillions more in new spending on infrastructure and other priorities. The federal purse is open, and politicians have sticky fingers. The Democrat-controlled Congress is reinstating earmarks this year, and members of both parties are dashing for cash. Three of Iowa's U.S. representatives have filed earmark requests, totaling more than $51 million. The Gazette's James Q. Lynch recently reported the requests span an array of infrastructure and community projects. Ashley Hinson wants $1 million to expand the parking apron at the Independence Municipal Airport. Marionette Miller Meeks is seeking $5 million for career counselors at the community college in her hometown of Ottumwa. Cindy Axney has requested $725,000 for outdoor play equipment and other improvements at a child care center in Ringgold County. Iowa's Republican Representative Randy Feenstra and Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley are not requesting kickbacks, maintaining the Obama view that the practice is wasteful. Even at its peak, earmarks were tiny compared to federal spending on health care, Social Security, and the military. Their comeback won't necessarily trigger a new spending spree, but it does represent an embrace of the old business as usual in Washington, D.C. In the current Congress, earmarks act as a potentially powerful form of legal bribery. Lawmakers who are on the fence about a spending package might be won over by a sweetheart deal for their constituents back home. Who's to thank or blame for the new era of federal largesse? Former President Donald Trump, for one. Trump in 2018 unsuccessfully called for reviving earmarks, which he said brought great friendliness to Congress. He also oversaw a double-digit increase in the national debt even before pandemic expenses came up. While previous Republican presidents at least paid lip service to sound budgeting, Trump gladly embraced runaway spending. The one-term president still is the leader of the Republican Party. His big spending record gives cover to fellow Republicans looking to siphon federal dollars for local pet projects. Big government is back, and it's bipartisan. Again, that's by Adam Sullivan. And one community letter today, angry about unnecessary voting changes in Iowa. There were other letters that I considered writing, but this topic has stayed with me. I voted in 2020. I did not cheat. I did not commit fraud, but my Republican representatives in the House and Senate and the governor obviously think I did. I can hear the screaming and gnashing of teeth coming from them, but frankly, at this point, I do not care. They voted for a change in Iowa election law based on the lie that voters committed fraud. Democratic voters. About 76% of eligible voters voted in the last election, third largest in the nation. Yet not really impressive when one out of four eligible voters did not cast a ballot. And Republicans want you to believe that of those who did vote, some were not eligible, and therefore it became necessary to put roadblocks up to make it more difficult. They have not explained why requiring citizens to sign a petition to get satellite voting, shortening the hours of voting, eliminating drop boxes to make returning a ballot easier became necessary. We're probably supposed to be grateful that they did not include provisions to overturn an election and pick whoever they want. I'm not grateful. I am angry. And that's signed by Carolyn L. Stucker from Springville. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, and now we turn to today's obituary page. In the short notices from Cedar Rapids, Reverend Dr. K. Slocum Dillon, age 84, died Sunday, June 6, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. In Monona, Richard Lee Stickler, age 76, died Saturday, June 5, Leonard Grau Funeral Home, Monona. In Monticello, Virgil Hunt, age 93, died Monday, June 7, the Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. In Olwine, Mildred, known as Millie Seifert, age 97, died Monday, June 7, Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Olwine. In Spillville, Helen Beatrice Schmidt Timp, age 89, died Tuesday, April 27, Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. And in Winthrop, Ronald Reck, age 91, died Sunday, June 6th. The Fawcett Schmidt Funeral Home in Winthrop is in charge. Moving now to the regular notices, from Cedar Rapids, Blaine V. Holmes, M.D., age 68, from Cedar Rapids, died peacefully at his home on June 6th of amyloidosis, a blood cell malignancy. Private interment will occur at a later date. from Anamosa, Lois M. Latham Vandenberg, known as Flo, age 78, of Anamosa, passed away Thursday, June 3, at Hospice of Mercy in Hiawatha. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 10, at Oakwood Cemetery in Monticello. From Blairstown, Terry Lee Newton, age 77, passed away Monday, June 7, at his home in Blairstown with his family by his side. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, June 10, at Grace Lutheran Church in Blairstown, with the Reverend Jeff Schonbacher officiating. Interment will be held at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Blairstown. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the church. A memorial fund has been established. From Oxford, Larry H. Ogden, age 80, of Oxford, formerly of North Liberty, died at home, surrounded by family on June 1. Larry had extended wishes that a private family graveside service be planned and burial take place in the Rochester, Iowa cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Birdhouse, Johnson County Hospice Home, or Iowa City Hospice. From Sigourney, John H. Knutson, age 93, formerly of Marion, died June 5. Graveside service will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday in the Garden of the Cross at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Arrangements are by the Home Funeral Home in Sigourney. From Cedar Rapids, Vivian Ruth Lawrence, age 85, died Saturday, June 5, at her home. Per her wishes, no services will be held. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. In Cedar Rapids, Brian Bruce Pomeroy, age 63, died Sunday, June 6th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House following a long battle with COPD. Services are at 5 p.m. Thursday at the Tian Funeral Home by Penny Ackerman. Burial will take place at Spring Grove Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family from 4 to 7 Wednesday at the funeral home. In Coggan, Deb McGraw, age 63, passed away Saturday, June 5, at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Per Deborah's wishes, cremation has taken place. The family will greet friends from 11 to 1 Saturday, June 12, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City. Interment will follow at 2 p.m. Saturday at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Coggan. In Cedar Rapids, Elizabeth May Warren Westcott, age 84, of Brainerd, Minnesota, died Friday, January 8, 2021, at Central Minnesota Senior Care Facility due to acute respiratory failure due to COVID-19. She was cremated on January 12, 2021. Burial service will be Wednesday, June 9, at 11 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life will immediately follow the burial at Thomas Park in Marion, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family of Elizabeth. From Iowa City, Geraldine, known as Jerry Ruth Miltner Lynch, age 93, died Wednesday, June 2. The family will celebrate a massive Christian burial at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 15, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Burial will follow at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Solon. A visitation will be from 4 to 6 Monday, June 14th, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, with a rosary at 3:30 p.m. In Decorah, Diane M. Svensson, age 77, passed away in her sleep at home Friday, June 4. A memorial mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 10, at St. Benedict Catholic Church in Decorah, with the Reverend Donald Hertges officiating. Interment will be at the St. Benedict Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m. Thursday, 2 hours before the service at the church. And from Iowa City, Leon Charles Green, age 71, passed away peacefully June 4 at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. He had fought chronic lymphocytic leukemia for over 15 years. Leon died at last from complications of a stroke. To honor Leon's wishes, cremation has taken place. His family will have a celebration of his life that will take place at a later date. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service is serving the family. Moving now to the sports page, in this story by Nathan Ford, Girls Soccer, a state title rematch in the first round. The first inkling came on May 6th. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union girls soccer rankings that day had Waverly Shellrock number 1 and Cedar Rapids Xavier number 8 in Class 2A. Considering the girls' state soccer tournament is seeded by the IGHSAU's rankings, that 1-versus-8 pairing was an intriguing possibility. Surely in the next month, though, something would change. The final rankings came along on May 26th. Waverly Shellrock, the 2019 2A runner-up, still number 1. Cedar Rapids Xavier, the most recent 2A champion, still number 8. Okay, but there at least would be an upset in the regional finals, right? Some lower-ranked team will put these perennial powers on the opposite sides of the bracket. Not this year. The top 8 teams all advanced. As such, it's a state tournament rematch in today's girls' state soccer quarterfinals. The Saints at 13-5 and the Gohawks at 16-2 kick off at County Soccer Park at 12:30 p.m. It's a tough first game, Xavier coach Chris Higgins said. I don't think we're that far apart, a 1 seed and an 8 seed. Look no further than the team's regular season meeting on, of course, May 6. Number 1, Waverly Shellrock prevailed 2-1. At number 8, Xavier, with an overtime golden goal from the University of Iowa signee Kenzie Rowling. Xavier, the top-ranked team in the season's first ranking, had slipped with a 3-2 loss to North Scott in April. I think we're traditionally slow starters, Higgins said. It always takes us a few games to get going. The Saints' other losses were to ranked 3A teams, 2-0 in the season opener to West Des Moines Dowling, and 1-0 defeats later in May to Iowa City West and Linmar. That's not the resume of a typical number 8 team, but the Saints have stayed behind number 6 North Scott in the rankings since that defeat. Number 7 Dallas Center Grimes, by the way, also gave the Gohawks a game, losing 3-2 on a 3 second half goals, including 2 from Rowling on May 1. This has all the makings of a wide-open 2A tournament. Since we've played Waverly, we've had really tough games, Higgins said. Close game against Linmar, close game against Iowa City West. Even though there are losses, I liked playing those tough games, so we're prepared, and we're in those situations of knowing what to do when we're in a tough game. Even though we've got those losses, which probably hurt us in the rankings, when it comes to state, we're in a good spot because we've played those hard contests. Xavier won the 2019 title 2-1 in an overtime goal from then-sophomore Ella Klusner. Rowling scored 38 goals as a sophomore that season, but was kept off the board in the final. The second straight year, WSR finished second. This year, Rowling has a state-high 68 goals, and the Gohawks are carrying a 15-game winning streak to state. They're similarly tested, with losses to 3A qualifiers number 5 Ankeny Centennial and number 1 West Des Moines Valley. It's just unfortunate we're playing them in the first game, Higgins said, but I think we would have had to play somewhere along the line if we were to go far again. In sports of area interest today, high school golf state co-ed tournaments, 9 a.m., Class 2A at Elmwood in Marshalltown and Class 1A at American Legion Golf Course in Marshalltown. In high school tennis, the state co-ed tournaments, 8 a.m., Class 2A at Prairie Ridge Sports Complex in Ankeny, Class 1A at Waveland Tennis Courts in Des Moines. And in high school baseball, Jefferson plays at Kennedy at 7 p.m., City Highs at Liberty, Washington at Mount Vernon, Keokuk at Marion, and Cascade at Regina. On the softball side, Prairie plays at Washington, Cedar Falls at Linmar, Waterloo East at Jefferson, Waterloo West is at Kennedy, Cascade plays at Regina, City High at Western Dubuque, Xavier at Dubuque Hempstead, and Iowa City West at Dubuque Senior, Liberty at Dubuque Wallard. And it's state tournament time at the James County Soccer Complex in Des Moines for girls soccer, Xavier versus Waverly Shell Rock at 12:30 p.m. Moving now to the community page in the Eastern Iowa briefs for today from Cedar Rapids. Next Freedom Festival activity box pickup starts on Thursday. The next round of Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival art activity boxes will be given out Thursday and Friday. Boxes will be available from the Cedar Rapids Parks and Rec Department's Roland Recmobile stop from 1:30 to 3:30 Thursday at Green Square and from 1:30 to 3:30 Friday at Beaver Park. Boxes are first come, first served, and there is a maximum of two per family. When we started to take a look at what in-person programming would look like in 2021, we weren't sure if families would feel comfortable with our normal kids' activities like bouncy houses, face painting, sharing building blocks, and so on during a pandemic, said Carol Shepherd, Freedom Festival Executive Director. The festival will be partnering with the Eastern Iowa Arts Academy to provide all the supplies for kids age 6 to 16 to create a piece of printmaking artwork. After it's completed, families are asked to mail the artwork to the EIAA, which will create a large community art mural that will be displayed June 26th at the Volta Youth Music Festival at Nubo City Market. The Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival returns June 14 to July 4th and follows public safety guidelines and recommendations of the Linn County Public Health and City of Cedar Rapids. For updates, go online to freedomfestival.com or on the Facebook page for the Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival. Volunteers are needed for the Cedar Rapids Hunger Fight. Meals from the Heartland is seeking 400 volunteers to register to package meals during the 4th annual Cedar Rapids Hunger Fight, sponsored by Transamerica and Cargill. The Iowa-based nonprofit has a goal to package 150,000 meals from Thursday to Saturday to be distributed around the Cedar Rapids area. The packaging will be at the Doubletree Convention Complex, 350 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Many two-hour shifts are available during the morning, afternoon, and evening. Sign up individually or with a business, church, or civic group. Volunteer registration is available. Volunteers will be packaging Taco Mac meals in a safe, socially distanced manner. We are confident we can meet this goal with the help of our caring community, said Meals from the Heartland Executive Director Greg DeHa. Meals from the Heartland's mission is to feed starving children in Iowa, across the U.S., and around the world. We work year-round to do that, of course, but due to the pandemic, feeding those in need in Iowa has been even more critical. And in Marion, Music Under the Moon concert returns on Saturday. After a hiatus in 2020, the Music Under the Moon concert series returns this summer to the Klopfenstein Amphitheater stage at Lowe Park, 4500 North 10th Street in Marion. Three touring acts will take the stage. The schedule is Saturday, Remembering John Denver, Ted Vigil's tribute to John Denver. On July 17, Boy Band Review. And on August 14, Arch Allies Music Under the Moon concerts are free, but to ensure adequate spacing for attendees, reservations are required, and only a limited number of spots will be available. Reservations will open Friday at noon, 2 weeks before each concert. Reservation for Ted Vigil's tribute to John Denver are now available. The event-specific reservation links are at cityofmarion.org. Guests will be checked in upon arrival and asked to present a valid reservation for attendance. For current event protocols, visit cityofmarion.org/COVID-19 response. Guests are encouraged to bring chairs or blankets for general lawn seating. Outside food and drink are permitted, and select vendors will be on site during the event. Also on the community page, A Taste of Reality, this story by Elijah Desius. 2020 was a challenging year for virtually everyone, but to those living with food insecurity, there were even more layers of difficulty to meet their basic needs. On Friday, those who wish to help can experience for an hour what those families go through on a daily basis. Community Crisis Services and Food Bank will host its fifth annual Hunger Banquet virtually through an immersive experience in the realities of food insecurity in Johnson County. All proceeds of the fundraiser will benefit the food bank, which serves 900 households each week with supplemental grocery assistance. For folks truly experiencing food insecurity, regularly going to bed malnourished, the effect isn't just an empty stomach and hunger pains, said Julia Winter, developmental manager at the food bank. Hunger is really much more than that feeling of emptiness. Children who experience hunger or malnourishment are at higher risk for chronic diseases later in life, mental health issues, and issues of living day to day, like poor performance in school during key development periods in their lives. Food insecurity has been tied to heart disease, diabetes, and cancer, Winter said. And for children who watch parents sacrifice their own food so that they can eat, the trauma of watching other adults go hungry is lasting. For $50, the public can help Community reach its fundraising goal of $55,000, which will stock its shelves for nearly 6 months. The Hunger Banquet is the food bank's largest annual fundraiser. We've developed this virtual event to help educate the community on food insecurity in Johnson County and to raise awareness and support for the food bank, said Sarah Nelson, Executive Director of Community. Attendees will learn about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected food insecurity in Johnson County and beyond through an engaging virtual presentation featuring community clients and volunteers. And like the in-person version of the Hunger Banquet, participants will be randomly assigned a financial demographic based on real income levels in Johnson County to determine the value of the meal they receive. Participants will receive gift cards of varying amounts based on their assigned financial demographic to purchase a meal from a restaurant or delivery service of their choice. Some will receive enough to purchase an upscale dinner, and some will receive enough to purchase a fast food meal. Others representing their neighbors who go to bed hungry will receive no meal at all. With about 15% of Iowans experiencing food insecurity now, Winter said the rate has nearly doubled since before the pandemic. 11% are children. That is an astronomically high number, and it's not something we're thinking when we see people out and about, she said. Between the pandemic, the derecho, civil unrest, and economic disaster, the food bank has been highly impacted. Our food bank staff also are shopping in the food bank, Winter said. It can happen to anyone. Most of our neighbors are just one paycheck away from being in crisis. Unlike some other assistance programs, Community does not have income guidelines for service qualification. And for those who receive supplemental nutrition assistance benefits, formerly known as food stamps, food banks cover the many gaps in family needs for not only food, but essentials like toilet paper, diapers, and hygiene products. We just want people to know there is help, Winter said. During the pandemic, Community provided prepackaged bags of food for clients that often results in lower satisfaction and more food waste. Since opening their new space at Pepperwood Plaza, the organization has had more room to safely distance and gain better footing to serve the community. A substantial need remains for volunteers both at the food bank and on the crisis phone line. Community's mobile pantry will go to 10 neighborhoods each month through the summer to counter accessibility issues with public transportation. And if you plan to attend, this event is on Friday. Social hour begins at 5:30. The rest of the program starts at 6:30, and it will be held virtually anywhere with an internet connection. To register, visit builtbycommunity.org/hungerbanquet2021. Registration is $50. All proceeds from this event are critical to the success of the food bank. The annual Hunger Banquet is the largest fundraiser for Community, providing enough funding to support the food bank for nearly 6 months. The event, happening live virtually, will include icebreakers and community trivia during the social hour. Back to an Iowa Today page story, Iowa eyes $3.6 billion for transportation. This story is by Rod Beauchart, the Gazette's Des Moines Bureau. Iowa transportation officials are expecting a fairly status quo highway improvement program over the next five-year planning period, with about $3.6 billion targeted toward projects aimed at enhancing safety and modernizing and maintaining Iowa's current network of roadways. Members of the state's Transportation Commission are slated to vote today on the draft plan presented to them Monday by the Iowa DOT. The state's 127-page proposed transportation plan for fiscal 2022 to 2026 covers investments in aviation, public transit, railroads, trails, rivers, and highways, with a $3.6 billion price tag that Stuart Anderson, director of the Iowa DOT's Planning, Programming, and Modal Division, called kind of a mind-boggling number. Included in the new five-year transportation plan is more than $1.2 billion in investments to upgrade Iowa's state-owned bridges. According to the Iowa DOT, the number of poor bridges in the state highway system was reduced from 256 in 2006 to 35 in 2020, but many bridges are due for repair or replacement, so ongoing upgrades remain a priority. Maintaining Iowa's interstate network also is a priority, with significant investment planned for six-lane improvements on Interstate 35 in Polk and Story counties and Interstate 80 in Dallas and Johnson counties. Mississippi River Bridge replacements on Interstate 74 in Bettendorf and I-80 in LeClaire. Interstate 380-80 interchange construction near Iowa City and I-380 Tower Terrace interchange in Hiawatha and I-80 reconstruction at Madison Avenue in Council Bluffs. New to the program is continuing an I-380 pavement rehabilitation and widening effort from north of Forever Green Road to north of Penn Street in North Liberty area. Resiliency work on Highway 2 from Horse Creek to Interstate 29 in Fremont County, and Super 2 or wider lane improvements on Highway 18 in Kossuth and Hancock counties, US 30 in Cedar County, and US 63 in Tama County. Iowa DOT officials say the state's transportation investment over the past years and in the coming years play a critical role in helping stabilize, recover, and transition to a growing economy as the nation works through a public health pandemic with unprecedented financial changes. In the letter to commissioners, said Federal Highway Trust Fund revenue currently would not cover funding levels anticipated throughout the state's five-year plan. In the unlikely event this is not addressed by Congress, drastic cuts to the federal highway program are possible. If this occurs, we will have to make significant changes to the program, with the potential to reduce funding for highway and bridge projects to about $500 million in the plan. You've been listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Program, for today, June 8th. A copy of today's recording is available anytime on IRIS. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.